would never reach his own wand in time. "The Dark Lord and I," said Moody, and he looked completely insane now, towering over Harry, leering down at him, "have much in common. Both of us, for instance, had very disappointing fathers, very disappointing indeed. Both of us suffered the indignity, Harry, of being named after those fathers, and both of us had the pleasure, the very great pleasure, of killing our fathers to ensure the continued rise of the Dark Order."
"You're mad," Harry said. He couldn't stop himself. "You're mad."
"Mad, am I?" said Moody, his voice rising uncontrollably. "We'll see. We'll see who's mad, now that the Dark Lord has returned with me at his side. He is back, Harry Potter. You did not conquer him, and now I conquer you."
Moody raised his wand. He opened his mouth. Harry plunged his own hand into his robes.
"Stupefy!"
There was a blinding flash of red light, and with a great splintering and crashing, the door of Moody's office was blasted apart. Moody was thrown backward onto the office floor. Harry, still staring at the place where Moody's face had been, saw Albus Dumbledore, Professor Snape, and Professor McGonagall looking back at him out of the faux glass. He looked around and saw the three of them standing in the doorway, Dumbledore in front, his wand outstretched. At that moment, Harry fully understood for the first time why people said Dumbledore was the only wizard Voldemort had ever feared. The look upon Dumbledore's face as he stared down at the unconscious form of Mad-Eye Moody was more terrible than Harry could have ever imagined. There was no benign smile upon Dumbledore's face, no twinkle in the eyes behind the spectacles. There was cold fury in every line of the ancient face. A sense of power radiated from Dumbledore, as though he were giving off burning heat. He stepped into the office, placed a foot underneath Moody's unconscious body, and kicked him over onto his back so that his face was visible. Snape followed him, looking into the faux glass where his own face was still visible, glaring into the room. Professor McGonagall went straight to Harry.
"Come along, Potter,"
she whispered. The thin line of her mouth was twitching as though she was about to cry.
"Come along, hospital wing."
"No,"
said Dumbledore sharply.
"Dumbledore, he ought to. Look at him, he's been through enough tonight. He will stay, Minerva, because he needs to understand,"
said Dumbledore curtly.
"Understanding is the first step to acceptance, and only with acceptance can there be recovery. He needs to know who has put him through the ordeal he has suffered tonight, and why."
"Moody,"
Harry said. He was still in a state of complete disbelief.
"How can it have been Moody?"
"This is not Alastor Moody,"
said Dumbledore quietly.
"You have never known Alastor Moody. The real Moody would not have removed you from my sight after what happened tonight. The moment he took you, I knew, and I followed."
Dumbledore bent down over Moody's limp form and put a hand inside his robes. He pulled out Moody's hip flask and a set of keys on a ring. Then he turned to Professors McGonagall and Snape.
"Severus, please fetch me the strongest truth potion you possess, and then go down to the kitchens and bring up the house elf called Winky. Minerva, kindly go down to Hagrid's house, where you will find a large black dog sitting in the pumpkin patch. Take the dog up to my office. Tell him I will be with him shortly. Then come back here."
If either Snape or McGonagall found these instructions peculiar, they hid their confusion. Both turned at once and left the office. Dumbledore walked over to the trunk with seven locks, fitted the first key in the lock, and opened it. It contained a mass of spell books. Dumbledore closed the trunk, placed a second key in the second lock, and opened the trunk again. The spell books had vanished. This time it contained an assortment of broken sneakerscopes, some parchment and quills, and what looked like a silvery invisibility cloak. Harry watched, astounded, as Dumbledore placed the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth keys in their respective locks, reopening the trunk each time and revealing different contents each time. Then he placed the seventh key in the lock, threw open the lid, and Harry let out a cry of amazement. He was looking down into a kind of pit, an underground room, and lying on the floor some 10 feet below, apparently fast asleep, thin and starved in appearance, was the real Mad-Eye Moody. His wooden leg was gone, the socket that should have held the magical eye looked empty beneath its lid, and chunks of his grizzled hair were missing. Harry stared, thunderstruck, between the sleeping Moody in the trunk and the unconscious Moody lying on the floor of the office. Dumbledore climbed into the trunk, lowered himself, and fell lightly onto the floor beside the sleeping Moody. He bent over him.
"Stunned! Controlled by the imperious curse. Very weak," he said. "Of course they would have needed to keep him alive. Harry, throw down the impostor's cloak. He's freezing. Madame Pomfrey will need to see him, but he seems in no immediate danger."
Harry did as he was told. Dumbledore covered Moody in the cloak, tucked it around him, and clambered out of the trunk again. Then he picked up the hip flask that stood upon the desk, unscrewed it, and turned it over. A thick, glutinous liquid splattered onto the office floor.
"Polyjuice potion, Harry," said Dumbledore. "You see the simplicity of it, and the brilliance. For Moody never does drink except from his hip flask. He's well known for it. The impostor needed, of course, to keep the real Moody close by, so that he could continue making the potion. You see his hair?"
Dumbledore looked down on the Moody in the trunk.
"The impostor has been cutting it off all year. See where it is uneven. But I think, in the excitement of tonight, our fake Moody might have forgotten to take it as frequently as he should have done. On the hour, every hour. We shall see."
Dumbledore pulled out the chair at the desk and sat down upon it, his eyes fixed upon the unconscious Moody on the floor. Harry stared at him, too. Minutes passed in silence. Then, before Harry's very eyes, the face of the man on the floor began to change. The scars were disappearing. The skin was becoming smooth. The mangled nose became whole and started to shrink. The long mane of grizzled grey hair was withdrawing into the scalp and turning the colour of straw. Suddenly, with a loud clunk, the wooden leg fell away as a normal leg regrew in its place. Next moment the magical eyeball had popped out of the man's face as a real eye replaced it. It rolled away across the floor and continued to swivel in every direction. Harry saw a man lying before him, pale-skinned, slightly freckled, with a mop of fair hair. He knew who he was. He had seen him in Dumbledore's pensive, had watched him being led away from court by the Dementors, trying to convince Mr. Crouch that he was innocent. But he was lined around the eyes now, and looked much older. There were hurried footsteps outside in the corridor. Snape had returned with Winky at his heels. Professor McGonagall was right behind them.
"Crouch!" Snape said, stopping dead in the doorway. "Barty Crouch!" "Good heavens!" said Professor McGonagall, stopping dead and staring down at the man on the floor.
Filthy, dishevelled, Winky peered around Snape's legs. Her mouth opened wide, and she let out a piercing shriek.
"Master Barty! Master Barty! What is you doing here?"
She flung herself forward onto the young man's chest.
"You is killed him! You is killed him! You is killed Master's son!"
"He is simply stunned, Winky," said Dumbledore. "Step aside, please. Severus, you have the potion?"
Snape handed Dumbledore a small glass bottle of completely clear liquid, the Veritaserum with which he had threatened Harry in class. Dumbledore got up, bent over the man on the floor, and pulled him into a sitting position against the wall, beneath the faux glass, in which the reflections of Dumbledore, Snape, and McGonagall were still glaring down upon them all. Winky remained on her knees, trembling, her hands over her face. Dumbledore forced the man's mouth open and poured 3 drops inside it. Then he pointed his wand at the man's chest and said,
"Enervate!"
Crouch's son opened his eyes. His face was slack, his gaze unfocused. Dumbledore knelt before him so that their faces were level.
"Can you hear me?"
Dumbledore asked quietly. The man's eyelids flickered.
"Yes,"
he muttered.
"I would like you to tell us," said Dumbledore softly, how you came to be here. How did you escape from Azkaban?
Crouch took a deep, shuddering breath, then began to speak in a flat, expressionless voice. My mother saved me. She knew she was dying. She persuaded my father to rescue me as a last favor to her. He loved her as he had never loved me. He agreed. They came to visit me. They gave me a draught of polyjuice potion containing one of my mother's hairs. She took a draught of polyjuice potion containing one of my hairs. We took on each other's appearance. Winky was shaking her head, trembling.
Say no more, Master Barty! Say no more! You is getting your father into trouble!
But Crouch took another deep breath and continued in the same flat voice. The Dementors are blind. They sensed one healthy, one dying person entering Azkaban. They sense one healthy, one dying person leaving it. My father smuggled me out, disguised as my mother in case any prisoners were watching through their doors. My mother died a short while afterward in Azkaban. She was careful to drink polyjuice potion until the end. She was buried under my name and bearing my appearance. Everyone believed her to be me. The man's eyelids flickered.
"And what did your father do with you when he had got you home?" said Dumbledore quietly.
"Stage my mother's death. A quiet, private funeral. That grave is empty. The house elf nursed me back to health. Then I had to be concealed. I had to be controlled. My father had to use a number of spells to subdue me. When I had recovered my strength, I thought only of finding my master, of returning to his service."
"How did your father subdue you?"
said Dumbledore.
"The Imperious Curse," Crouch said. "I was under my father's control. I was forced to wear an invisibility cloak day and night. I was always with the house elf. She was my keeper and caretaker. She pitied me. She persuaded my father to give me occasional treats, rewards for my good behavior."
"Master Barty, Master Barty,"
sobbed Winky through her hands.
"You isn't ought to tell them. We is getting in trouble."
"Did anybody ever discover that you were still alive?" said Dumbledore softly. "Did anyone know, except your father and the house elf?"
"Yes," said Crouch, his eyelids flickering again. "A witch in my father's office, Bertha Jorkins. She came to the house with papers for my father's signature. He was not at home. Winky showed her inside and returned to the kitchen, to me. But Bertha Jorkins heard Winky talking to me. She came to investigate. She heard enough to guess who was hiding under the invisibility cloak. My father arrived home. She confronted him. He put a very powerful memory charm on her to make her forget what she'd found out. Too powerful. He said it damaged her memory permanently."
"Why is she coming to nose into my master's private business?"
sobbed Winky.
"Why isn't she leaving us be?"
"Tell me about the Quidditch World Cup," said Dumbledore.
"Winky talked my father into it," said Crouch, still in the same monotonous voice. "She spent months persuading him. I had not left the house for years. I had loved Quidditch. Let him go," she said. "He will be in his invisibility cloak. He can watch. Let him smell fresh air for once." She said my mother would have wanted it. She told my father that my mother had died to give me freedom. She had not saved me for a life of imprisonment. He agreed in the end. It was carefully planned. My father led me and Winky up to the top box early in the day. Winky was to say that she was saving a seat for my father. I was to sit there, invisible. When everyone had left the box, we would emerge. Winky would appear to be alone. Nobody would ever know. But Winky didn't know that I was growing stronger. I was starting to fight my father's imperious curse. There were times when I was almost myself again. There were brief periods when I seemed outside his control. It happened there, in the top box. It was like waking from a deep sleep. I found myself out in public in the middle of the match, and I saw in front of me a wand sticking out of a boy's pocket. I had not been allowed a wand since before Azkaban. I stole it. Winky didn't know. Winky is frightened of heights. She had her face hidden.
"Master Barty, you bad boy,"
whispered Winky, tears trickling between her fingers.
"So you took the wand," said Dumbledore. "And what did you do with it?"
"We went back to the tent," said Crouch. "Then we heard them. We heard the Death Eaters, the ones who had never been to Azkaban, the ones who had never suffered for my master. They had turned their backs on him.
They were not enslaved, as I was. They were free to seek him, but they did not. They were merely making sport of Muggles. The sound of their voices awoke me. My mind was clearer than it had been in years. I was angry. I had the wand. I wanted to attack them for their disloyalty to my master. My father had left the tent. He had gone to free the Muggles. Winky was afraid to see me so angry. She used her own brand of magic to bind me to her. She pulled me from the tent, pulled me into the forest away from the Death Eaters. I tried to hold her back. I wanted to return to the campsite. I wanted to show those Death Eaters what loyalty to the Dark Lord meant, and to punish them for their lack of it. I used the stolen wand to cast the dark mark into the sky. Ministry wizards arrived. They shot stunning spells everywhere. One of the spells came through the trees where Winky and I stood. The bond connecting us was broken. We were both stunned. When Winky was discovered, my father knew I must be nearby. He searched the bushes where she had been found, and felt me lying there. He waited until the other ministry members had left the forest. He put me back under the imperious curse and took me home. He dismissed Winky. She had failed him. She had let me acquire a wand. She had almost let me escape. Winky let out a wail of despair. Now it was just Father and I, alone in the house, and then... Crouch's head rolled on his neck, and an insane grin spread across his face. My master came for me. He arrived at our house late one night in the arms of his servant, Wormtail. My master had found out that I was still alive. He had captured Bertha Jorkins in Albania. He had tortured her. She told him a great deal. She told him about the Triwizard Tournament. She told him the old Auror Moody was going to teach at Hogwarts. He tortured her until he broke through the memory charm my father had placed upon her. She told him I had escaped from Azkaban. She told him my father kept me in prison to prevent me from seeking my master. And so my master knew that I was still his faithful servant, perhaps the most faithful of all. My master conceived a plan based upon the information Bertha had given him. He needed me. He arrived at our house near midnight. My father answered the door. The smile spread wider over Crouch's face, as though recalling the sweetest memory of his life. Winky's petrified brown eyes were visible through her fingers. She seemed too appalled to speak. It was very quick. My father was placed under the imperious curse by my master. Now my father was the one imprisoned, controlled. My master forced him to go about his business as usual, to act as though nothing was wrong. And I was released. I awoke. I was myself again, alive as I hadn't been in years.
"And what did Lord Voldemort ask you to do?" said Dumbledore.
"He asked me whether I was ready to risk everything for him. I was ready. It was my dream, my greatest ambition, to serve him, to prove myself to him. He told me he needed to place a faithful servant at Hogwarts, a servant who would guide Harry Potter through the Triwizard Tournament without appearing to do so, a servant who would watch over Harry Potter, ensure he reached the Triwizard Cup, turn the cup into a port key, which would take the first person to touch it to my master. But first,
you needed a Lastor Moody," said Dumbledore.
His blue eyes were blazing, though his voice remained calm.
"Wormtail and I did it. We had prepared the Polyjuice potion beforehand. We journeyed to his house."
Moody put up a struggle.
There was a commotion. We managed to subdue him just in time, forced him into a compartment of his own magical trunk, took some of his hair and added it to the potion. I drank it. I became Moody's double. I took his leg and his eye. I was ready to face Arthur Weasley when he arrived to sort out the Muggles who had heard a disturbance. I made the dustbins move around the yard. I told Arthur Weasley I had heard intruders in my yard who had set off the dustbins. Then I packed up Moody's clothes and dark detectors, put them in the trunk with Moody, and set off for Hogwarts. I kept him alive under the imperious curse. I wanted to be able to question him, to find out about his past, learn his habits, so that I could fool even Dumbledore. I also needed his hair to make the Polyjuice potion. The other ingredients were easy. I stole Boomslang's skin from the dungeons. When the potion's master found me in his office, I said I was under orders to search it.
"And what became of Wormtail after you attacked Moody?" said Dumbledore.
"Wormtail returned to care for my master in my father's house and to keep watch over my father."
"But your father escaped?" said Dumbledore.
"Yes. After a while he began to fight the imperious curse, just as I had done. There were periods when he knew what was happening. My master decided it was no longer safe for my father to leave the house. He forced him to send letters to the ministry instead. He made him write and say he was ill. But Wormtail neglected his duty. He was not watchful enough. My father escaped. My master guessed that he was heading for Hogwarts. My father was going to tell Dumbledore everything, to confess. He was going to admit that he had smuggled me from Azkaban. My master sent me word of my father's escape. He told me to stop him at all costs. So I waited and watched. I used the map I had taken from Harry Potter. The map that had almost ruined everything.
"Map?" said Dumbledore quickly. "What map is this?"
"Potter's map of Hogwarts. Potter saw me on it. Potter saw me stealing more ingredients for the polyjuice potion from Snape's office one night. He thought I was my father. We have the same first name. I took the map from Potter that night. I told him my father hated dark wizards. Potter believed my father was after Snape. For a week I waited for my father to arrive at Hogwarts. At last, one evening, the map showed my father entering the grounds. I pulled on my invisibility cloak and went down to meet him. He was walking around the edge of the forest. Then Potter came, and Crumb. I waited. I could not hurt Potter. My master needed him. Potter ran to get Dumbledore. I stunned Crumb. I killed my father.
No!
Wailed Winky.
Master Barty! Master Barty! What is you saying?
You killed your father?
Dumbledore said in the same soft voice.
What did you do with the body?
Carried it into the forest, covered it with the invisibility cloak. I had the map with me. I watched Potter run into the castle. He met Snape. Dumbledore joined them. I watched Potter bringing Dumbledore out of the castle. I walked back out of the forest, doubled around behind them, went to meet them. I told Dumbledore Snape had told me where to come. Dumbledore told me to go and look for my father. I went back to my father's body, watched the map. When everyone was gone, I transfigured my father's body. He became a bone. I buried it, while wearing the invisibility cloak, in the freshly dug earth in front of Hagrid's cabin. There was complete silence now, except for Winky's continued sobs. Then Dumbledore said,
"And tonight?" "I offer to carry the Triwizard Cup into the maze before dinner," whispered Barty Crouch. "Turned it into a portkey. My master's plan worked. He has returned to power, and I will be honored by him beyond the dreams of wizards."
The insane smile lit his features once more, and his head drooped onto his shoulder as Winky wailed and sobbed at his side. Chapter 36 The Parting of the Ways. Dumbledore stood up. He stared down at Barty Crouch for a moment with disgust on his face. Then he raised his wand once more, and ropes flew out of it, ropes that twisted themselves around Barty Crouch, binding him tightly. He turned to Professor McGonagall.
"Minerva, could I ask you to stand guard here while I take Harry upstairs?"
"Of course,"
said Professor McGonagall. She looked slightly nauseous, as though she had just watched someone being sick. However, when she drew out her wand and pointed it at Barty Crouch, her hand was quite steady.
"Severus!" Dumbledore turned to Snape. "Please tell Madame Pomfrey to come down here. We need to get Alastor Moody into the hospital wing. Then go down into the grounds. Find Cornelius Fudge and bring him up to this office. He will undoubtedly want to question Crouch himself. Tell him I will be in the hospital wing in half an hour's time if he needs me."
Snape nodded silently and swept out of the room.
"Harry,"
Dumbledore said gently. Harry got up and swayed again. The pain in his leg, which he had not noticed all the time he had been listening to Crouch, now returned in full measure. He also realized that he was shaking. Dumbledore gripped his arm and helped him out into the dark corridor.
"I want you to come up to my office first, Harry,"
he said quietly as they headed up the passageway.
"Sirius is waiting for us there."
Harry nodded. A kind of numbness and a sense of complete unreality were upon him. But he did not care. He was even glad of it. He didn't want to have to think about anything that had happened since he had first touched the Triwizard Cup. He didn't want to have to examine the memories, fresh and sharp as photographs, which kept flashing across his mind. Mad-Eye Moody, inside the trunk. Wormtail slumped on the ground, cradling his stump of an arm. Voldemort rising from the steaming cauldron.
Cedric dead. Cedric, asking to be returned to his parents.
"Professor,"
Harry mumbled,
"where are Mr. and Mrs. Diggory?"
"They are with Professor Sprout,"
said Dumbledore. His voice, which had been so calm throughout the interrogation of Barty Crouch, shook very slightly for the first time.
"She was head of Cedric's house, and knew him best."
They had reached the stone gargoyle. Dumbledore gave the password. It sprang aside, and he and Harry went up the moving spiral staircase to the oak door. Dumbledore pushed it open. Sirius was standing there. His face was white and gaunt, as it had been when he had escaped Azkaban. In one swift moment he had crossed the room.
"Harry, are you all right?"
"I knew it. I knew something like this."
"What happened?"
His hands shook as he helped Harry into a chair in front of the desk.
"What happened?"
he asked more urgently. Dumbledore began to tell Sirius everything Barty Crouch had said. Harry was only half listening. So tired, every bone in his body was aching. He wanted nothing more than to sit here undisturbed for hours and hours until he fell asleep and didn't have to think or feel any more. There was a soft rush of wings. Forks, the phoenix, had left his perch, flown across the office, and landed on Harry's knee.
"Lo, Forks,"
said Harry quietly. He stroked the phoenix's beautiful scarlet and gold plumage. Forks blinked peacefully up at him. There was something comforting about his warm weight. Dumbledore stopped talking. He sat down opposite Harry behind his desk. He was looking at Harry, who avoided his eyes. Dumbledore was going to question him. He was going to make Harry relive everything.
"I need to know what happened after you touched the portkey in the maze, Harry," said Dumbledore.
"We can leave that till morning, can't we, Dumbledore?"
said Sirius harshly. He had put a hand on Harry's shoulder.
"Let him have a sleep. Let him rest."
Harry felt a rush of gratitude towards Sirius, but Dumbledore took no notice of Sirius's words. He leaned forward toward Harry. Very unwillingly, Harry raised his head and looked into those blue eyes.
"If I thought I could help you,"
Dumbledore said gently,
"by putting you into an enchanted sleep and allowing you to postpone the moment when you would have to think about what has happened tonight, I would do it. But I know better. Numbing the pain for a while will make it worse when you finally feel it. You have shown bravery beyond anything I could have expected of you. I ask you to demonstrate your courage one more time. I ask you to tell us what happened."
The phoenix let out one soft, quavering note. It shivered in the air, and Harry felt as though a drop of hot liquid had slipped down his throat into his stomach, warming him and strengthening him. He took a deep breath and began to tell them. As he spoke, visions of everything that had passed that night seemed to rise before his eyes. He saw the sparkling surface of the potion that had revived Voldemort. He saw the Death Eaters apparating between the graves around them. He saw Cedric's body lying on the ground beside the cup. Once or twice Sirius made a noise as though about to say something, his hands still tight on Harry's shoulder, but Dumbledore raised his hand to stop him, and Harry was glad of this because it was easier to keep going now he had started. It was even a relief. He felt almost as though something poisonous were being extracted from him. It was costing him every bit of determination he had to keep talking, yet he sensed that once he had finished, he would feel better. When Harry told of Wormtail piercing his arm with the dagger, however, Sirius let out a vehement exclamation, and Dumbledore stood up so quickly that Harry started. Dumbledore walked around the desk and told Harry to stretch out his arm. Harry showed them both the place where his robes were torn and the cut beneath them.
"He said my blood would make him stronger than if he'd used someone else's,"
Harry told Dumbledore.
"He said the protection my mother left in me, he'd have it too. And he was right. He could touch me without hurting himself. He touched my face."
For a fleeting instant, Harry thought he saw a gleam of something like triumph in Dumbledore's eyes. But the next second, Harry was sure he had imagined it, for when Dumbledore had returned to his seat behind the desk, he looked as old and weary as Harry had ever seen him.
"Very well,"
he said, sitting down again.
"Voldemort has overcome that particular barrier. Harry, continue, please."
Harry went on. He explained how Voldemort had emerged from the cauldron and told them all he could remember of Voldemort's speech to the Death Eaters. Then he told how Voldemort had untied him, returned his wand to him, and prepared to duel. But when he reached the part where the golden beam of light had connected his and Voldemort's wands, he found his throat obstructed. He tried to keep talking, but the memories of what had come out of Voldemort's wand were flooding into his mind. He could see Cedric emerging, see the old man, Bertha Jorkins, his father, his mother. He was glad when Sirius broke the silence.
"The wands connected," he said, looking from Harry to Dumbledore. "Why?"
Harry looked up at Dumbledore again, on whose face there was an arrested look.
"Priori incantatum," he muttered.
His eyes gazed into Harry's, and it was almost as though an invisible beam of understanding shot between them.
"The reverse spell effect," said Sirius sharply.
"Exactly," said Dumbledore. "Harry's wand and Voldemort's wand share cause. Each of them contains a feather from the tail of the same phoenix. This phoenix, in fact," he added,
and he pointed at the scarlet and gold bird perched peacefully on Harry's knee.
"My wand's feather came from Forks?" Harry said, amazed.
"Yes," said Dumbledore. "Mr. Ollivander wrote to tell me you had bought the second one the moment you left his shop 4 years ago."
"So, what happens when a wand meets its brother?" said Sirius.
"They will not work properly against each other," said Dumbledore. "If, however, the owners of the wands force the wands to do battle, a very rare effect will take place. One of the wands will force the other to regurgitate spells it has performed, in reverse, the most recent first, and then those which preceded it."
He looked interrogatively at Harry, and Harry nodded.
"Which means," said Dumbledore slowly, his eyes upon Harry's face, "that some form of Cedric must have reappeared."
Harry nodded again.
"Diggory came back to life," said Sirius sharply.
"No spell can reawaken the dead," said Dumbledore heavily. "All that would have happened is a kind of reverse echo. A shadow of the living Cedric would have emerged from the wand. Am I correct, Harry?"
"He spoke to me," Harry said. He was suddenly shaking again.
The ghost, Cedric, or whatever he was, spoke. "An echo," said Dumbledore, "which retained Cedric's appearance and character. I am guessing other such forms appeared. Less recent victims of Voldemort's wand."
"An old man," Harry said, his throat still constricted.
"Bertha Jorkins, and your parents," said Dumbledore quietly.
"Yes," said Harry. Sirius's grip on Harry's shoulder was now so tight it was painful.
"The last murders the wand performed," said Dumbledore, nodding. "In reverse order. More would have appeared, of course, had you maintained the connection. Very well, Harry. These echoes, these shadows, what did they do?"
Harry described how the figures that had emerged from the wand had prowled the edges of the golden web, how Voldemort had seemed to fear them, how the shadow of Harry's father had told him what to do, how Cedric's had made its final request. At this point, Harry found he could not continue. He looked around at Sirius and saw that he had his face in his hands. Harry suddenly became aware that Forks had left his knee. The phoenix had fluttered to the floor. It was resting its beautiful head against Harry's injured leg, and thick, pearly tears were falling from its eyes onto the wound left by the spider. The pain vanished, the skin mended. His leg was repaired.
"I will say it again," said Dumbledore, as the phoenix rose into the air and resettled itself upon the perch beside the door. "You have shown bravery beyond anything I could have expected of you tonight, Harry. You have shown bravery equal to those who died fighting Voldemort at the height of his powers. You have shouldered a grown wizard's burden and found yourself equal to it. And you have now given us all we have a right to expect. You will come with me to the hospital wing,
I do not want you returning to the dormitory tonight. A sleeping potion and some peace. Sirius, would you like to stay with him?"
Sirius nodded and stood up. He transformed back into the great black dog and walked with Harry and Dumbledore out of the office, accompanying them down a flight of stairs to the hospital wing. When Dumbledore pushed open the door, Harry saw Mrs. Weasley, Bill, Ron, and Hermione grouped around a harassed-looking Madame Pomfrey. They appeared to be demanding to know where Harry was and what had happened to him. All of them whipped around as Harry, Dumbledore, and the black dog entered, and Mrs. Weasley let out a kind of muffled scream.
"Harry! Oh, Harry!"
She started to hurry toward him, but Dumbledore moved between them.
"Molly!" he said, holding up a hand. "Please listen to me for a moment. Harry has been through a terrible ordeal tonight. He has just had to relive it for me. What he needs now is sleep and peace and quiet. If he would like you all to stay with him," he added, looking around at Ron, Hermione, and Bill, too, "you may do so, but I do not want you questioning him until he is ready to answer, and certainly not this evening."
Mrs. Weasley nodded. She was very white. She rounded on Ron, Hermione, and Bill as though they were being noisy, and hissed,
"Did you hear? He needs quiet."
"Headmaster,"
said Madame Pomfrey, staring at the great black dog that was Sirius.
"May I ask what—"
"This dog will be remaining with Harry for a while," said Dumbledore simply. "I assure you, he is extremely well trained. Harry, I will wait while you get into bed."
Harry felt an inexpressible sense of gratitude to Dumbledore for asking the others not to question him. It wasn't as though he didn't want them there, but the thought of explaining it all over again, the idea of reliving it one more time, was more than he could stand.
"I will be back to see you as soon as I have met with Fudge, Harry," said Dumbledore. "I would like you to remain here tomorrow until I have spoken to the school."
He left. As Madame Pomfrey led Harry to a nearby bed, he caught sight of the real Moody lying motionless in a bed at the far end of the room. His wooden leg and magical eye were lying on the bedside table.
"Is he okay?" Harry asked.
"He'll be fine,"
said Madame Pomfrey, giving Harry some pajamas and pulling screens around him. He took off his robes, pulled on the pajamas, and got into bed. Ron, Hermione, Bill, Mrs. Weasley, and the black dog came around the screen and settled themselves in chairs on either side of him. Ron and Hermione were looking at him almost cautiously, as though scared of him.
"I'm all right," he told them. "Just tired."
Mrs. Weasley's eyes filled with tears as she smoothed his bed covers unnecessarily. Madame Pomfrey, who had bustled off to her office, returned holding a small bottle of some purple potion and a goblet.
"You need to drink all of this, Harry," she said. "It's a potion for dreamless sleep."
Harry took the goblet and drank a few mouthfuls. He felt himself becoming drowsy at once. Everything around him became hazy. The lamps around the hospital wing seemed to be winking at him in a friendly way through the screen around his bed. His body felt as though it was sinking deeper into the warmth of the feather mattress. Before he could finish the potion, before he could say another word, his exhaustion had carried him off to sleep. Harry woke up, so warm, so very sleepy, that he didn't open his eyes, wanting to drop off again. The room was still dimly lit. He was sure it was still night-time, and had a feeling that he couldn't have been asleep very long. Then he heard whispering around him.
"They'll wake him if they don't shut up. What are they shouting about? Nothing else can have happened, can it?"
Harry opened his eyes blearily. Someone had removed his glasses. He could see the fuzzy outlines of Mrs. Weasley and Bill close by. Mrs. Weasley was on her feet.
"That's Fudge's voice," she whispered. "And that's Minerva McGonagall's, isn't it? But what are they arguing about?"
Now Harry could hear them too, people shouting and running toward the hospital wing.
"Regrettable, but all the same, Minerva,"
Cornelius Fudge was saying loudly.
"You should never have brought it inside the castle," yelled Professor McGonagall. "When Dumbledore finds out—"
Harry heard the hospital doors burst open, unnoticed by any of the people around his bed, all of whom were staring at the door as Bill pulled back the screens. Harry sat up and put his glasses back on. Fudge came striding up the ward. Professors McGonagall and Snape were at his heels.
"Where's Dumbledore?"
Fudge demanded of Mrs. Weasley.
"He's not here," said Mrs. Weasley angrily. "This is a hospital wing, Minister. Don't you think you'd do better to—"
But the door opened, and Dumbledore came sweeping up the ward.
"What has happened?"
said Dumbledore sharply, looking from Fudge to Professor McGonagall.
"Why are you disturbing these people? Minerva, I'm surprised at you. I asked you to stand guard over Barty Crouch.
There's no need to stand guard over him any more, Dumbledore," she shrieked. "The Minister has seen to that."
Harry had never seen Professor McGonagall lose control like this. There were angry blotches of colour in her cheeks, and her hands were balled into fists. She was trembling with fury.
"When we told Mr. Fudge that we had caught the Death Eater responsible for tonight's events," said Snape in a low voice, "he seemed to feel his personal safety was in question. He insisted on summoning a Dementor to accompany him into the castle. He brought it up to the office where Barty Crouch—" "I told him you would not agree, Dumbledore," Professor McGonagall fumed. "I told him you would never allow Dementors to set foot inside the castle, but—"
"My dear woman,"
roared Fudge, who likewise looked angrier than Harry had ever seen him,
"as Minister of Magic, it is my decision whether I wish to bring protection with me when interviewing a possibly dangerous—"
But Professor McGonagall's voice drowned Fudge's.
"The moment that— that thing entered the room," she screamed, pointing at Fudge, trembling all over, "it swooped down on Crouch, and—"
Harry felt a chill in his stomach as Professor McGonagall struggled to find words to describe what had happened. He did not need her to finish her sentence. He knew what the Dementor must have done. It had administered its fatal kiss to Barty Crouch. It had sucked his soul out through his mouth. He was worse than dead.
"By all accounts, he is no loss," blustered Fudge. "It seems he has been responsible for several deaths." "But he cannot now give testimony, Cornelius," said Dumbledore.
He was staring hard at Fudge, as though seeing him plainly for the first time.
"He cannot give evidence about why he killed those people."
"Why he killed them? Well, that's no mystery, is it?"
blustered Fudge.
"He was a raving lunatic. From what Minerva and Severus have told me, he seems to have thought he was doing it all on you-know-who's instructions."
"Lord Voldemort was giving him instructions, Cornelius," Dumbledore said. "Those people's deaths were mere by-products of a plan to restore Voldemort to full strength again. The plan succeeded. Voldemort has been restored to his body."
Fudge looked as though someone had just swung a heavy weight into his face. Dazed and blinking, he stared back at Dumbledore as if he couldn't quite believe what he had just heard. He began to sputter, still goggling at Dumbledore.
"You know who? Richard? Preposterous! Come now, Dumbledore!" "As Minerva and Severus have doubtless told you," said Dumbledore, "we heard Barty Crouch confess. Under the influence of Veritaserum, he told us how he was smuggled out of Azkaban, and how Voldemort, learning of his continued existence from Bertha Jorkins, went to free him from his father, and used him to capture Harry. The plan worked, I tell you. Crouch has helped Voldemort to return."
"See here, Dumbledore," said Fudge,
and Harry was astonished to see a slight smile dawning on his face.
You can't seriously believe that. You know who, back? Come now. Come now, certainly. Crouch may have believed himself to be acting upon you-know-who's orders, but to take the word of a lunatic like that, Dumbledore?
When Harry touched the Triwizard Cup tonight, he was transported straight to Voldemort,
said Dumbledore steadily.
He witnessed Lord Voldemort's rebirth. I will explain it all to you if you will step up to my office.
Dumbledore glanced around at Harry and saw that he was awake, but shook his head and said,
I am afraid I cannot permit you to question Harry tonight.
Fudge's curious smile lingered. He too glanced at Harry, then looked back at Dumbledore and said,
You are prepared to take Harry's word on this, are you, Dumbledore?
There was a moment's silence which was broken by Sirius growling. His hackles were raised, and he was baring his teeth at Fudge.
"Certainly, I believe, Harry," said Dumbledore. His eyes were blazing now. "I heard Crouch's confession, and I heard Harry's account of what happened after he touched the Triwizard Cup. The two stories make sense. They explain everything that has happened since Bertha Jorkins disappeared last summer." Fudge still had that strange smile on his face. Once again, he glanced at Harry before answering.
"You are prepared to believe that Lord Voldemort has returned on the word of a lunatic murderer and a boy who, well..."
Fudge shot Harry another look, and Harry suddenly understood.
"You've been reading Rita Skeeter, Mr. Fudge," he said quietly. Ron, Hermione, Mrs. Weasley and Bill all jumped. None of them had realized that Harry was awake.
Fudge reddened slightly, but a defiant and obstinate look came over his face.
"And if I have,"
he said, looking at Dumbledore,
"if I have discovered that you've been keeping certain facts about the boy very quiet, a parcel mouth, eh, and having funny turns all over the place..."
"I assume that you are referring to the pains Harry has been experiencing in his scar," said Dumbledore coolly.
"You admit that he's been having these pains, then?"
said Fudge quickly.
"Headaches, nightmares, possibly hallucinations?"
"Listen to me, Cornelius," said Dumbledore, taking a step toward Fudge. And once again he seemed to radiate that indefinable sense of power that Harry had felt after Dumbledore had stunned young Crouch.
"Harry is as sane as you or I. That scar upon his forehead has not addled his brains. I believe it hurts him when Lord Voldemort is close by or feeling particularly murderous."
Fudge had taken half a step back from Dumbledore, but he looked no less stubborn.
"You'll forgive me, Dumbledore, but I've never heard of a cursed scar acting as an alarm bell before." "Look, I saw Voldemort come back,"
Harry shouted. He tried to get out of bed again, but Mrs. Weasley forced him back.
"I saw the Death Eaters. I can give you their names. Lucius Malfoy."
Snape made a sudden movement, but as Harry looked at him, Snape's eyes flew back to Fudge.
"Malfoy was cleared," said Fudge, visibly affronted. "Very old family. Donations to excellent causes."
"McNair," Harry continued,
"also cleared. Now working for the Ministry.
Avery, Knott, Crabbe, Goyle."
"You are merely repeating the names of those who were acquitted of being Death Eaters 13 years ago,"
said Fudge angrily.
"You could have found those names in old reports of the trials. For heaven's sake, Dumbledore, the boy was full of some crackpot story at the end of last year, too. His tails are getting taller, and you're still swallowing them. The boy can talk to snakes, Dumbledore, and you still think he's trustworthy?"
"You fool!" Professor McGonagall cried.
"Cedric Diggory! Mr. Crouch, these deaths were not the random work of a lunatic!" "I see no evidence to the contrary!"
shouted Fudge, now matching her anger, his face purpling.
"It seems to me that you are all determined to start a panic that will destabilize everything we have worked for these last 13 years.
Harry couldn't believe what he was hearing. He had always thought of Fudge as a kindly figure, a little blustering, a little pompous, but essentially good-natured. But now a short, angry wizard stood before him, refusing point-blank to accept the prospect of disruption in his comfortable and ordered world, to believe that Voldemort could have risen.
"Voldemort has returned," Dumbledore repeated. "If you accept that fact straight away, Fudge, and take the necessary measures, we may still be able to save the situation. The first and most essential step is to remove Azkaban from the control of the Dementors."
"Preposterous!"
shouted Fudge again.
"Remove the Dementors? I'd be kicked out of office for suggesting it. Half of us only feel safe in our beds at night because we know the Dementors are standing guard at Azkaban.
The rest of us sleep less soundly in our beds, Cornelius, knowing that you have put Lord Voldemort's most dangerous supporters in the care of creatures who will join him the instant he asks them," said Dumbledore.
"They will not remain loyal to you, Fudge. Voldemort can offer them much more scope for their powers and their pleasures than you can.
With the Dementors behind him, and his old supporters returned to him, you will be hard-pressed to stop him regaining the sort of power he had 13 years ago.
Fudge was opening and closing his mouth as though no words could express his outrage.
"The second step you must take, and at once," Dumbledore pressed on, "is to send envoys to the Giants."
"Envoys to the Giants?"
Fudge shrieked, finding his tongue again.
"What madness is this?"
"Extend them the hand of friendship now before it's too late," said Dumbledore, "or Voldemort will persuade them, as he did before, that he alone among wizards will give them their rights and their freedom."
You cannot be serious,"
Fudge gasped, shaking his head and retreating further from Dumbledore.
"If the magical community got wind that I had approached the Giants... People hate them, Dumbledore! End of my career!"
"You are blinded,"
said Dumbledore, his voice rising now, the aura of power around him palpable, his eyes blazing once more.
"By the love of the office you hold, Cornelius, you place too much importance, and you always have done, on the so-called purity of blood. You fail to recognize that it matters not what someone is born, but what they grow to be. Your Dementor has just destroyed the last remaining member of a pure blood family as old as any, and see what that man chose to make of his life. I tell you now, take the steps I have suggested, and you will be remembered, in office or out, as one of the bravest and greatest ministers of magic we have ever known. Fail to act, and history will remember you as the man who stepped aside and allowed Voldemort a second chance to destroy the world we have tried to rebuild."
"Insane,"
whispered Fudge, still backing away.
"Mad."
And then there was silence. Madame Pomfrey was standing frozen at the foot of Harry's bed, her hands over her mouth. Mrs. Weasley was still standing over Harry, her hand on his shoulder to prevent him from rising. Bill, Ron, and Hermione were staring at Fudge.
"If your determination to shut your eyes will carry you as far as this, Cornelius," said Dumbledore, "we have reached a parting of the ways. You must act as you see fit, and I shall act as I see fit."
Dumbledore's voice carried no hint of a threat. It sounded like a mere statement. But Fudge bristled as though Dumbledore were advancing upon him with a wand.
"Now, see here, Dumbledore,"
he said, waving a threatening finger.
"I've given you free rein, always. I've had a lot of respect for you. I might not have agreed with some of your decisions, but I've kept quiet. There aren't many who'd have let you hire werewolves, or keep Hagrid, or decide what to teach your students without reference to the Ministry. But if you're going to work against me..."
"The only one against whom I intend to work," said Dumbledore, "is Lord Voldemort. If you are against him, then we remain, Cornelius, on the same side."
It seemed Fudge could think of no answer to this. He rocked backward and forward on his small feet for a moment, and spun his bowler hat in his hands. Finally, he said with a hint of a plea in his voice,
"He can't be back, Dumbledore. He just can't be."
Snape strode forward past Dumbledore, pulling up the left sleeve of his robes as he went. He stuck out his forearm and showed it to Fudge, who recoiled.
"There," said Snape harshly. "There, the dark mark. It is not as clear as it was an hour or so ago when it burned black, but you can still see it. Every Death Eater had the sign burned into him by the Dark Lord. It was a means of distinguishing one another, and his means of summoning us to him. When he touched the mark of any Death Eater, we were to disapparate, and apparate instantly at his side. This mark has been growing clearer all year, Karkaroff's too. Why do you think Karkaroff fled tonight? We both felt the mark burn. We both knew he had returned. Karkaroff fears the Dark Lord's vengeance. He betrayed too many of his fellow Death Eaters to be sure of a welcome back into the fold.
Fudge stepped back from Snape, too. He was shaking his head. He did not seem to have taken in a word Snape had said. He stared, apparently repelled by the ugly mark on Snape's arm, then looked up at Dumbledore and whispered,
"I don't know what you and your staff are playing at, Dumbledore, but I've heard enough. I have no more to add. I will be in touch with you tomorrow, Dumbledore, to discuss the running of this school. I must return to the Ministry."
He had almost reached the door when he paused. He turned around, strode back down the dormitory, and stopped at Harry's bed.
"Your winnings,"
he said shortly, taking a large bag of gold out of his pocket and dropping it onto Harry's bedside table.
1,000 galleons. There should have been a presentation ceremony, but under the circumstances...
He crammed his bowler hat onto his head and walked out of the room, slamming the door behind him. The moment he had disappeared, Dumbledore turned to look at the group around Harry's bed.
"There is work to be done," he said. "Molly, am I right in thinking that I can count on you and Arthur?" "Of course you can," said Mrs. Weasley.
She was white to the lips, but she looked resolute.
"We know what Fudge is. It's Arthur's fondness for muggles that has held him back at the Ministry all these years. Fudge thinks he lacks proper wizarding pride."
"Then I need to send a message to Arthur," said Dumbledore.
"All those that we can persuade of the truth must be notified immediately, and he is well placed to contact those of the Ministry who are not as short-sighted as Cornelius."
"I'll go to Dad," said Bill, standing up. "I'll go now."
"Excellent," said Dumbledore. "Tell him what has happened. Tell him I will be in direct contact with him shortly. He will need to be discreet, however. If Fudge thinks I am interfering at the Ministry..."
"Leave it to me," said Bill. He clapped a hand on Harry's shoulder, kissed his mother on the cheek, pulled on his cloak, and strode quickly from the room.
"Minerva," said Dumbledore, turning to Professor McGonagall, "I want to see Hagrid in my office as soon as possible. Also, if she will consent to come, Madame Maxime."
Professor McGonagall nodded and left without a word.
"Puppy," Dumbledore said to Madame Pomfrey, "would you be very kind and go down to Professor Moody's office, where I think you will find a house-elf called Winky in considerable distress. Do what you can for her, and take her back to the kitchens. I think Dobby will look after her for us."
"Very, very well,"
said Madame Pomfrey, looking startled, and she too left. Dumbledore made sure that the door was closed, and that Madame Pomfrey's footsteps had died away before he spoke again.
"And now," he said, "it is time for two of our number to recognize each other for what they are. Sirius, if you could resume your usual form..."
The great black dog looked up at Dumbledore, then, in an instant, turned back into a man. Mrs. Weasley screamed and leapt back from the bed.
"Sirius Black!"
she shrieked, pointing at him.
"Mom, shut up!"
Ron yelled.
"It's okay!"
Snape had not yelled or jumped backward, but the look on his face was one of mingled fury and horror.
"Him!"
he snarled, staring at Sirius, whose face showed equal dislike.
"What is he doing here?"
"He is here at my invitation," said Dumbledore, looking between them. "As you are, Severus. I trust you both. It is time for you to lay aside your old differences and trust each other."
Harry thought Dumbledore was asking for a near miracle. Sirius and Snape were eyeing each other with the utmost loathing.
"I will settle in the short term,"
said Dumbledore, with a bite of impatience in his voice,
"for a lack of open hostility. You will shake hands. You are on the same side now. Time is short, and unless the few of us who know the truth do not stand united, there is no hope for any of us."
Very slowly, but still glaring at each other, as though each wished the other nothing but ill, Sirius and Snape moved toward each other and shook hands. They let go extremely quickly.
"That will do to be going on with,"
said Dumbledore, stepping between them once more.
"Now, I have work for each of you. Fudge's attitude, though not unexpected, changes everything. Sirius, I need you to set off at once. You are to alert Remus Lupin, Arabella Fig, Mundungus Fletcher, the old crowd. Lie low at Lupin's for a while. I will contact you there."
"But," said Harry, he wanted Sirius to stay. He did not want to have to say goodbye again so quickly.
"You'll see me very soon, Harry,"
said Sirius, turning to him. I promise you, but I must do what I can. You understand, don't you?
Yeah, said Harry. Yeah, of course I do.
Sirius grasped his hand briefly,